All right. So you guys can start sitting, but you can also, throughout the course of this experience together, encourage you to stand up and to kind of come around, you know, make yourself comfortable. This isn't going to be a standard sit and just listen. We'd love for participation. A number of you are going to be called on to sit in these chairs and represent different parts of your brain. And so if you're feeling a little spongy this morning, then that's good, because that's what we need is parts of the brain. So I just want to give a little bit of an introduction of why are we doing this and what's going on, and why did you take my seat away from me, all of that. So obviously these last couple of weeks has been really, really sweet, just spending some time over Palm Sunday and Easter, just reveling in what Jesus did for us. And Golgotha, really appreciate David and Ann, all that they did to put effort into that, Scott and Pat and Sam. And so we've spent the last number of weeks just enjoying and looking deeper and reflecting on Jesus' sacrifice for us and the power of the new birth. And if you remember, all the way back to before Palm Sunday, we were in a series talking about spiritual formation and the idea of we are the clay, God is the potter. And so much that's critical in the understanding of spiritual formation is that God wants, what did Jesus say the most important commandment is? To love him with all of our heart, our soul, our mind, our strength. And so the idea there to me is that there's a lot of parts to us, and there's a whole being that Jesus is looking to wrap up in his plan of what love looks like. And so how does this intersect with Michael and Claudia? As they've, they'll get a chance to share a little bit of their story. Spiritual formation is not just doing actions and singing the songs and letting the words come out of your mouth. We understand it's such a deeper inner whole being attitude of following Jesus. And often we find that if you're like me, parts of that is hard, and parts of that can get stuck, and parts of that go, I don't know if I want to do that, Jesus. I can do the action physically, but internally to me, I find resistance. Why do those things get hard? Why does fear crop up when that thing happens? Why does shame crop up? Why is it hard for me to keep my identity in a certain group of people? And all these different aspects as we go deeper into this walk with Christ. And so something that Pat and I and a number of us have really enjoyed is the last year or two probably, we stumbled upon the book that Michael and Jim Wilder co-wrote called The Other Half of Church. And it really started to explain to us what's going on there at a brain science level. And what I'd love for you to hear today is not just these are brain hacks, right? Like if you just do these things, it's like giving your brain a shot of sugar or something like that. But this is the way God wired us. This is how you were hardwired to operate and to live and to relate. And God knows those things. And as they've stumbled upon those things, both through brain research and also through searching the scriptures, they start to see, wow, God is really infinitely wise to tell us to be thankful. There's something that's going on inside of us when we start to operate in thankfulness. There's something that goes inside of us when we start to attach to one another, to care for one another. There's something profound, and that's all part of our spiritual formation of what God's creating us into in his image. And so these guys have done a lot more work on that. We decided it'd probably just be better for them to come in and to share and for them to share their experiences. And as you go through this, you'll probably have some more questions afterward. This is going to be a running conversation that we're going to continue to have. This isn't the last time that we'll talk about this. But I'd love for you to consider as we're going to go through the brain, and Michael's going to walk us through this, is this is a very spiritual thing, okay? You do have a brain. You have an organ of a brain. You also have a will, and you have a soul. And there's parts of you that can start to see these things can get broken in us, these parts that we are going to walk through. God has answers for healing. God has answers for comforting. God has answers for helping us to get unstuck when we're crippled by fear, when we're crippled by shame, when we're just locked down in anger, when these parts of us just take over and we go, I can't do anything, God has solutions. And these aren't just brain hacks. This is a way of following Jesus in every component of who we are, every part of our inner being. And so what I'd love for you to hear is this is part of a discipleship that Jesus is walking each of us into, a heart discipleship. Our whole being, heart, soul, mind, strength, every other part, our psyche, all of that that Jesus wants to touch on. And so with that, I want to give it over to Michael and Claudia, give them a chance to introduce themselves and then walk us through. You guys are going to be, this is a highly participatory morning. So be ready to jump up. And if you would like to stand and kind of be on the sidelines, all of that, please don't sit on the sidelines this morning. We're going to jump in together with this.
Welcome, everyone. So a little bit about our story. I did not grow up in a Christian family, didn't go to church. Probably about the only time I went to church growing up is when I would visit my grandmother in Nebraska, because she would make me go. But my grandpa would stay home. My grandpa that did all the fun things, he would stay home and I would go to church with the women. And so for me growing up, I just thought, well, church is, you know, my only opinion really was church was kind of boring, right? But later, as we see God often does, I started having like an existential question, I would say like late high school, college age, about the meaning of life. Like, what is this life all about? What is the meaning of it? And, you know, I studied science stuff, so I knew that, you know, the prevailing theory was that this is just all a big accident and we're here. And even life was just an accident, just kind of developed on its own. And I thought of that, and I thought, well, then that seems to mean that there's no purpose or direction. It's not going anywhere. There's no plan behind it, right? But then when I looked around and saw people living their lives, almost no one was living their life as though it had no meaning. So I'm like, there's a disconnect here. And it was in the middle of that where one night I started reading the Bible. I couldn't fall asleep. It's the summer after my freshman year of college. Couldn't fall asleep, but I started reading the Bible, and basically I read the first five chapters of Matthew, and God essentially, though I didn't hear his voice, I sensed God saying, Michael, I see this question you have about the meaning of life, and you're going to find the answer to this question as you read about and get to know my son, Jesus. Now, I didn't hear any of those words. I just heard him in my mind, which to me, not going to church, not having anything, I thought, this is weird. Why am I hearing someone's thoughts in my mind that aren't from me? How is this happening? So even as I'm becoming a Christian, everything's new to me, but I'm asking all these questions of things I didn't understand. We're actually going to talk about the part of our brain that allows us to share minds with another person. And we believe as well it's the same place that helps us share the thoughts with Jesus. It's actually designed into our brain. It's facilitated by the Holy Spirit for us to do it with Jesus. With each other, we do it through our senses, through our eyes, through the sounds and smells and connections we have, expressions on our face, things like that. We share minds that way. Our minds actually are bigger than our brains, our skulls. It's out here, and we can share minds and start thinking the same thoughts. And we believe we can do this with Jesus. And so eventually, I got into a Christian group and started growing like crazy. You know, got out into life and everything, and went to seminary, and then eventually Claudia and I started going to a church that really started growing like crazy. I became an elder of that church, was an elder for a good 10 years, and then they asked me to become the pastor of discipleship. So this was a church that was growing fast. We had lots of brand new believers, but we didn't really have a plan to beyond getting them to know Jesus. They got to Jesus and just come to our meeting and go to our things, but we didn't really have a plan. So they said, Michael, why don't you become our discipleship pastor and try to figure that out? And so I just started coming up with plans. We did like a Bible reading plan. I did a spiritual practices 5-week training people in our church would go through. Over 800 people went through that training. I also wrote a book for brand new Christians that explained a lot of the basic things, because when I became a Christian, people would use words and I didn't know what those words meant. Like evangelism, let's go do some evangelism. I'm like, okay, what is that, right? Or even, you know, at our church, we would often have people come up to the pastor after the sermon and said, that was a really good sermon. But when you had that thing up there on the screen that said COL3:16, what's that mean, right? Where's the decoder ring for that? And so I wrote a book that just kind of explains all the basics and brings people back, you know, kind of into the basics of how we walk with Jesus. How do we grow? So I started doing all these things and kept running into the same thing over and over again. That is that it's like these practices we're doing were some people were transformed by them, and other people I would see, it almost seems like they didn't work for them. You know, we would do trainings on spiritual practices. We'd have round tables with 8 people at a table, and we had like 10 tables. And even people, 2 people at the same table, one would come up to me afterwards. One man came up to actually and said, after this 5-week training, he said, "I think this 5-week training saved our marriage," which I didn't really design it to save anybody's marriage, but that was very encouraging. Same table, another person comes up and said, "Michael, this stuff just goes over my, it just did, I can't connect with this." And I kept running into that over and over again, even with the Bible reading plan, something as simple as a Bible reading plan. Someone came up to me that said, I have never read the Bible regularly every day. This is completely changing. I feel like closer to Jesus than I've ever felt. And another person came up to me and said, "I tried it for a couple of days. I can't read this. I just doesn't work for me." And so as a pastor of discipleship, I got to the point where I realized I don't know how to do my job, because I feel like I'm missing big pieces of the puzzle about how we grow as followers of Jesus. How do we mature, right? And that was almost like a prayer. It's almost like, "Dear God, I don't know how to do my job as a pastor. Amen." And God heard that prayer, right? Because a couple weeks later, after, you know, after actually having that prayer, someone, you know, he didn't answer that prayer in a visible way, but I got a phone call a couple weeks later of a man visited our church, called me up, said, "Michael, I am an elder of a church in Denver, and we visited your church, a team of us, to see what you're doing in your church, and I saw what you were doing. I saw your book. I grabbed a copy, and I looked you up on your website of your church, of all the discipleship stuff you're doing." And he goes, "I'm a friend of Dallas Willard, who's kind of this discipleship guru. He wrote a bunch of books on discipleship." He said, "Dallas used to say a lot of people are reading my books on discipleship, but almost no churches are doing it." And he looked at me across the table and he said, "Michael, you are doing it," because we went out to lunch. And I said, normally that'd be a compliment. And I said, "Yeah, I'm doing it. But, you know, why does it seem to work, these practices we do? Why does it seem to work sometimes and doesn't work other times? Why does it work really well for certain kind of life problems and other kinds of life problems? It seems that people need more than just the usual Christian answers." I almost felt embarrassed saying that, but I got to the point where I'm just going to say it. And I said, "I feel like I have more questions than answers about how discipleship, how we grow as Christians. For example, a couple questions that I had was, number one, why did I sometimes see my non-Christian friends treating people better than some of my Christian friends I knew? Not all of them, not a blanket statement, but why did I sometimes see that? Why did I sometimes see actual Christian leaders, pastors, leaders of Christian organizations, leaders of Christian universities acting in ways that didn't look to me like Jesus at all? Why was that happening? Another question I had is, why did I hear and come across so many people that came out of churches just deeply, deeply wounded? And I would say even traumatized. Why was that happening? And so I'm asking him these questions and he's looking at me and he goes, "You know, Michael, maybe we should start meeting together and start diving into some of these questions in discipleship and try to figure out, what are we missing? And why does it work? And why are we seeing these things in the Christian community?" And so we started having lunch every month. I pulled another friend in with me. And we started just reading, watching sermons, looking at teachings about discipleship and try to understand, how do we make this thing work better? What are we missing? What are we not understanding? And it was in the middle of those meetings, maybe 6 months in, where this man said an interesting thing. He said, "You know, one area of discipleship we haven't touched on yet in all our reading and everything we've done is the brain and what role neuroscience plays in discipleship." And when he said this, I thought, what are you talking about? Right? I have no idea what you, I told him, "Well, I have no idea what you mean. What do you mean the brain in discipleship?" And he kind of got a little smile on his face and he says, "Well, Michael, let me invite my friend, Dr. Jim Wilder to our lunch next month, because I think he can answer that question better than I can." And so the following month we got together again in our discipleship study group thing. And this new man was here, We're talking and he looks at me across the table and says, Michael, what would you like out of this meeting, out of this lunch? Like, what are you looking for? And I kind of shared some of the questions I just shared with you. Like, why does this not work more consistently? Why does it work sometimes for some people and not for other people? You know, all this kind of stuff. And he looked at me for a moment. He was slow to speak. And then he said, Michael, I think it might help you to understand a little bit about how God designed the human brain to mature us and to grow our character if you want answers to these questions. And then he were sitting around a table and he bent over and he pulled out a plastic brain. And he unhooked the left side and the right side and he started explaining to us all around how the Bible processes our relational surroundings to form our character and to form our identities and to form who we are. Right? How did God design us to actually mature? And that was one of my big questions. Why don't we see more radical transformation character? And why do I run in my, this is not just the people out there in our church too. Why are the things in my life that have seemed almost stubborn and resistant to change using the usual Christian answers that I've been given? Those same Christian practices radically have changed other areas of my life, but why are there some areas that seem almost stubborn? Can anybody relate? I think we all have those stubborn areas. Most of us have more than one, right? Things we want to change and don't know how. And so Jim had his brain out and he started walking us through the control processor of the brain, explaining how it works, okay? And how the brain processes our surroundings and forms our character. So this is what we're going to do today. Instead of using a plastic brain, we're going to actually use a brain in real life with some of you sitting in these roles and playing the role of each part of this, okay? So this is the human control processor of the brain. This is not the entire brain, but it's the control processor. It's the thing that guards the flow and facilitates the flow of everything else the brain does, right? And this person is looking that direction. And so these four levels, 2, 3, 4, are all on the right brain, looking that way, right? This person's eye is down below these three chairs and down below this chair, looking that way. Okay, and so one of the first things Jim Wilder said about the brain is everything that every way we can sense our surroundings eventually ends up into the back right part of our brain here and goes here and travels from the back to the front on the right side. Like, for example, the smell of coffee, the sounds of that car accelerating outside, the looks on the faces of the people around you, right? Our smell senses, anything we can sense goes from the back to the right, on the up to the front on the right side, and then it crosses over behind your two eyes and then goes from front to back on the left side. Okay? Kind of like when you go into King Supers and you're on, go walk down one aisle and then you cross over and come back on the other aisle in the supermarket, right? Our brain that follows that path in everything it does, except for one exception that we'll get to. Okay? I never even heard that before. Did any of you know that before who haven't been in our trainings? I didn't even know that. It's like I knew nothing about the brain. Yeah.
So going back to the psalm that we read at the beginning of the service today, this is not something that is going to change what we believe, but I want to explain it. So, because the first time I hear this, I say, what is this? This is weird. This is not Christian. Where is this coming from? So what we want to say is this is not to change what we believe. This is not to bring another doctrine or another theology, but it's just say, oh, the first person that got to see a brain from the inside, because years ago it was impossible. They needed to wait until somebody died to see it. But now, like around, 30, 20-something years ago, they put an electrode and saw it in a screen. So and they were not Christians, but they say, wow, this is literally a relational machine. And it's made out of those levels. So this is just to make more sense of what we know.
And so Jim said, we really have two brains, not one brain. but they're two brains that work together, the right side and the left side. And they go at different speeds. Like the right side, he calls the fast track because it goes 12 times a second from 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, these four. The left side actually is more complex. We're boiling it down to one chair, but it does a bunch of other stuff, but it is a lot slower. It goes like 5 times a second, okay? And the right side focuses on different things than the left side, but they're meaning to be coherent, right? The right side is our relational, social, emotional brain, okay? And so it deals with everything having to do with our connections to one another and how we love well. It's really a love machine, attachment machine on the right side. The left side is an explanation machine. It's always trying to put into words what's going on over here and explaining it. The left brain is what comes up with strategies, like I'm going to do this, how do we do this, plans. It's our willpower, left brain. Believing the right things, left brain. Right? Good teaching, left exercises our left brain really well. Not necessarily our right brain. Our right brain's exercised by other things. And then Jim Wilder said a really interesting thing that I've never forgotten. He said, one of the reasons we don't see more transformation in our churches and we get stuck in our maturity growth is because most of our discipleship is really aimed at this side, giving us good information, which is very important, and good strategies and using our willpower and making better choices. And he said, but character change is predominantly a right brain activity. Not entirely, there's definitely right, left brain's important, but the right brain is the dominant side for character change, and yet we've put most of our discipleship practices training the left brain.
Or loving our enemies. Loving our enemies is a function that happens here.
Michael, could you just real quick, just because many have not read the book, yep, but have some understanding, could you, with the one sentence explanation you gave us, the difference between our soul and our brain, because the world talks a lot about the brain as the only, because you can't, there can't be a spiritual in secular psychology. So
right.
It can only be.
Okay. Yeah, the soul is really the totality of the human being, including our spirit and our body and everything else. Our spirits actually are built, and God's spirit as well, they're built. Our brain is built to interact with the spiritual realm, right? And so this whole thing was designed with a relationship with God in mind, right? But this is not the totality of who we are. As a matter of fact, when we die, we go to heaven in spirit form when we no longer have a body, meaning we no longer have a brain. But we're still, I'm still Michael, she's still Claudia, right? And then sometime in the future, I think the Bible says at the last trumpet, we receive a body that's, Paul calls it two things, imperishable and immortal. We receive another body. I believe it's going to have a brain, but it's even going to be like a turbo. Who knows? Nobody understood. Even Paul was saying, you know, when you read about Paul doing it, he goes, why don't you understand these things? But when I'm reading it, I'm like, Paul, I don't understand these things either. What are you talking about? The people are asking him these questions. I didn't understand either, right? But this is not the totality of who we are as human beings, but is meant to interface with other people as well as in the spirit realm, okay?
So maybe just to clarify your question, I think when we hear the word brain, we are all thinking in here. We are all thinking, oh, brain is intellectual. This person has a big brain, or this person is super smart. But that is not the brain. The brain has one part that processes our thoughts, and the brain has another half that processes our identity, our relationships, the way we love and connect. So this is kind of the computer that runs the way we know who we are and how we connect with others. The left brain is kind of the part of the computer that processes more of the thoughts and the processing, and it makes sense.
And I think this will make sense more. You know, this is our social, relational, emotional brain. This is the thing, that's why I called the book we wrote, The Other Half of Church, because our discipleship is largely focused here. And we say, well, what does it look when we bring the other half in? Keep doing the good stuff with the left brain and bring a greater training of the right brain in addition, right? And so what we're going to do is we're going to start walking some things through the brain and show you actually what this means. Because when Jim Wilder with his plastic brain started explaining it, I probably understood maybe a third of what he was saying. It's like, I don't think I understand this. But this helps you kind of see a little bit better, okay? And so here's what we're going to do is we're going to start explaining the five levels, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and what they do. And then we're going to run some real life situations through them, okay? So level one is what we call the attachment level. Okay, can I have someone come and sit in this seat and play the attachment part of our brain? Don't be shy. It's not a speaking form, so if you want to, it's not a... So each one of these levels has a different focus. It's like processing it at a different level. And this is the attachment level. This is level one, first thing we do, and it's basically asking the question, is this personal to me? Is this relevant to me? Okay. Because a lot of things come at us in life, but most of it's not relevant to us in our brain. When it's not relevant to me, personal to me, it gets dismissed. If it's relevant to me, it gets passed on to level two. Make sense? For example, who of you, when you came in today, noticed that little, you see the clock to the right, upper right, there's that little white square there. Who of you noticed that today when you came in? Usually there's one IT guy that puts his hand up because I got to replace the batteries in that thing, or I'm the one who cut that hole because I had to rewire this or that. They have an answer, so it's not, so it is personal to them. Every one of our brains, our eyes saw that and said, that's not relevant right now, dismiss it. Right? It's like when you park your car at DIA, you go on a trip, you come back and it's like, where did I put my car? And you're going and it's no car, no car, no car, no car, right? Until you see your car, bing, that's personal to me. But we do this with people as well. Like Clyde and I go to Mexico a lot to do trainings, and when you land at Mexico City and go through get your luggage and go through everything. And then you come out like here to a sea of Mexican faces. My level one's going, not personal to me, not personal to me, not personal to me. And then I see Jorge Ortega, my friend. Bing, bing, bing. He's personal to me. And then that gets passed through. Okay? Make sense? So if it's personal to me, it gets passed through to level two. So this is the attachment level, and this is the assessment level. So can I have three volunteers for three seats? And these will be a speaking role. So if you don't mind speaking, have a seat. So once something is personal to me, it gets passed on to level two, and level two has an opinion. It basically has three opinions of everything that happens in our life, right? And what the three opinions we can have on something is that it is good, say good.
Good.
Bad. Scary.
Scary.
Okay? Everything that happens in life, our amygdala has an opinion on it, okay? And once it forms an opinion, it never changes. Ever, till the day we die. But it can be added to, right? And so also the interesting thing about this is that when we're born as babies, this is basically the only brain we have, right? As the baby is born and the baby starts interacting with the mother, first of all, just by laying on her body and smelling her smell, and then later as they start interacting and looking at each other and smiling and building joy, the mother's actually downloading level three to this baby. So level three is formed by interactions of joy and quiet between mother and child, largely. Father too, but mother's the dominant one here, building this part. We even call this the mother core, because you largely get your mother's part of level three, okay? But when a baby is born, when the baby's in the womb, this is the brain they have, right? So it's still doing good, bad, scary in the womb. Things can be scary in the womb. When we have surgery and we're put under anesthesia, this is still running, right? When we're unconscious, when we're sleeping. Basically, when these two stop running, we're dead. This runs from the, before we're born, even in the womb, it runs, and it runs till the day we die, okay?
And we have zero control
And we also have no direct awareness. Okay? We have indirect awareness of what's going on here, but we don't have any direct awareness. Okay, we'll talk about that in a second. So let's say that Pastor Nathan comes in right now with a box of ice cream sandwiches as we're doing this, and he starts handing them out to you, and he walks up to you and asks you if you want an ice cream sandwich. Is that personal to you, him coming up and asking if you want an ice cream? That's personal, definitely. He's walking up to me. Is that good, bad, or scary?
Good.
For 99.99% of us, ice cream is good, right? Now, if you have like a violent dairy allergy or something, you might get it bad, right? But for most of us, that's a good thing. And then it's passed on to here, okay? Does that make sense? And so there's a dotted line between levels 2 and level 3 called the cortex right here. So something that's subcortical, these, we have no direct awareness of. Something that's after the cortex, we actually have awareness of these, but we have no control over them. No direct control, but we know what's going on, right? And so, but it's not under our willpower. It's very fast, okay? So ice cream is personal to me, it's good. And the next thing the brain looks at then is level 3, which is the attunement level. Can I have 2 people sit in these chairs? Got 1. Another brave one. Good. There's competition. So we, you know, this is kind of like the gatekeeper of our brain. When things aren't personal to us, they don't even get let in. And then this assesses it, good, bad, or scary, or combination of the 2, of the 3. And then the next question it asks again, this is the mother core. And this is asking, it's called the attunement level. And it's saying, basically asking the question, level 3 is really seeking what is going on in the mind of another. And what it's asking is, do the people around me get me here? Are they sharing what I'm sharing? Do they know what's going on inside of me? Or am I alone here and nobody understands me? That's what attunement is, right? If a baby cries and the mother goes, oh, what's wrong, baby? And she puts her finger in the diaper to see if it's wet. Oh, no, it's dry. Huh, I wonder what, oh, I bet you need some milk, right? That seems like a very trivial thing, but that's personal to the baby. You know, being hungry is probably bad. And then mom coming and saying, oh, I'm so sorry, what's wrong? And tries to, what is the mom communicating at the attunement level? Is I care about you. And I'm going to figure out what's going wrong because I love you and I'm going to understand. And and the baby can feel just from mother's face that mom understands what's going on inside of me. That something's wrong and she's trying to fix it. Right?
And it's glad to be with me and I'm not alone.
I'm not alone in my trouble or in my joy.
Somebody's gay.
Even in good things. You can get an A on a test. Let's say you get an A on a test in second grade. And you bring it home all proud to mom and say, mom, look what I got. And she goes, oh, set that over there. I need you to help me set the table. That's a case where this is getting an A on a test personal to me? Is it good, bad, or scary?
Good.
And yet my mother did not attune to me in my success too. We need attunement in success, in failure. We need to attunement in big things and in little things. As a matter of fact, this is the way God's family works. We are a people that share each other's emotions. You know, we read that in the Bible where we rejoice with those who rejoice, we cry with those who cry. That is level 3. And when we don't get attuned to well, that's when things start breaking down in our lives. Okay? We've all been in situations where things went wrong and nobody got me. And I felt all alone in it, right? That's painful, isn't it? That's called level 3 pain, where we feel alone in our emotions. And the church is meant to be a place where we are with each other's emotions and we walk with each other and show each other compassion and kindness in the middle of good stuff and hard stuff and exciting stuff and boring stuff and everything else, okay? But this starts very young, very important to infants, okay? Anything else on level 3? Did I get it all, Clow? Okay. So,
you know, this is nonverbal. All this happens without any words.
Yeah, the baby's brain knows within a fraction of a second if mom gets me or if dad gets me, right? That's why it's so important, because it's actually left eye to left eye really fast thing, where they can see on my face before any words come out of my mouth, they can tell whether they're all alone or if I'm like, I'm with you, right? Have you ever been in a meeting at work or a situation and you're in the meeting, maybe something happens, like your boss blames you for something and you can feel your face going red. And then you look across the table to your friend that you work with and they're looking at you and they're like this. And all of a sudden you go, oh, I'm not alone. My friend gets me. Boom. You just energize this part, because this part can actually shut down like a breaker. Right? But when it gets energized by attunement, it doesn't shut down. We stay ourselves, and we can go into level 4, which is the thing that can handle the unpleasant things in life well. Okay? Level 4, so this is, again, a review. This is the what level?
Attachment.
This one? Assessment. Attunement. Again, we're attuning to each other's emotions. There's not an A word for this one because this is more complex. It's the joy and identity level. Okay, and you're going to see why that is for a second. Can I have 3 other volunteers? There was one over here who tried. If you want to get one, honor your speed. 2 more people, please. One more. There we go. This is the right prefrontal cortex, okay? And this is kind of the CEO of our brain. This is the thing that's meant to be in control of our brain and is farming things out. This will even give the left brain stuff to do and everything else. This is the thing that regulates our emotions and help us from kind of melting down our emotions, that we can actually regulate them. This is the thing that stores who I am. So I know who I am and something. Have you ever been in a situation where you go, I have no idea who I am here in this situation? This thing's above me. That means your prefrontal cortex looked for a file and it couldn't find one. You got like a file not found. All sorts of interesting things. Look, joy is stored here. This is the joy center. It's the identity center. Okay? If we go back to babies, mother's nursing a baby. The baby's full. They stop nursing. Mom's just holding the baby. The baby looks up at the mother. Mother looks down at the baby. Little bit of a smile, baby, little bit of smile, mother, and then baby, mother, it start doing this thing called joy, going up Joy Mountain together. Baby, mother, baby, mother, baby. And they go up, and this is just working out this whole path right here, right? Like I am, you know, I'm with my mother, and she's holding me. I smell her. I see her. She's smiling. I'm smiling back. This is very, very good. Mom is happy to be with me. I can tell she's happy to be with me. And then you don't even need this part of the brain to do that. So really in the first 4 to 6 months, you're really working out this part of the brain. This is just starting to come online. But they're working this out with these going up Joy Mountain. Pretty soon the baby has so much joy that the baby needs a rest, right? And so what babies will do, this is interesting, they'll break eye contact with mother as they're smiling. And here's the wise mother. The wise mother lets the baby break eye contact. The mother stops smiling. The mother stops building joy with the child. And instead, the mother rests with the baby. Joy is good. Mom's smiling at me. That's good, right? And then when I have so much joy, I need a break and I need to rest. And mom lets me rest. Guess what that is? That's good. But what if mom keeps trying to smile with me when I need rest? That doesn't feel so good, right? Or what if I want to build joy, but mommy's not there to build joy, and I feel like no one wants to build joy with me, right? So the key to building a good level 3 is that what we called attuned interactions with the baby, where we're looking for what the baby wants to build joy, but we also give the baby rest when the baby needs rest. And the babies in the first 4 months of life, they go through this joy, rest cycle up to 200 times a day or something. Several hundred times a day they do this in the first 4 months of life. And it's the process by which this part of the brain is downloaded from the mother to the baby. Okay? Pretty amazing, isn't it? Fathers also build joy. Grandpa, grandma, siblings, but the primary one is the mother building joy in this stage, okay? Well, as this starts to form in too, this is the deeper, more complex part of the brain. This is called the couple bond area of the brain. This is a one-on-one bond. This is called the family bond area. This is teaching us to be social and who we are in social situations. So the prefrontal cortex, how it works is I'm sitting in this seat. We each are sitting in one of these three chairs. And people we are bonded to sit in the other two chairs and they get swapped out, right? When we're a baby, they can't get swapped out. So when I'm a baby, I actually need mom and dad in these chairs often. And when I have a high joy relationship with mother and I can tell she's happy to be with me, and also I have joy with my father and he's happy to be with me, and I also see my mother and father acting in joy with each other and they're glad to be with each other while still maintaining being happy to be with me, it's kind of like this joyful triangle, then I have an identity, a joyful identity that does not easily break. It's like a three-legged stool that does not easily tip over, right? And that is not the prefrontal cortex I received. I think when I was a baby is when my two parents started having marital problems. I think I had pretty good joy with my mom. I think my dad was detached, and I think there was tension between them, so I was not getting this what I needed, right? And so as a result, I got into high school and I didn't really know who I was well, because this didn't get developed well in a family. But there's very good news, is the prefrontal cortex is the area of the brain that continues to produce baby or fetal biology till the day we die. So this thing can always learn. So this is not a lifetime fatal, you know, it's not fatalistic. We can always grow this later, what we did not receive in our families. Some of us had very, very good high joy families that triangle between me and mom and dad. Many of us did not, though. Some of us, one of the parents wasn't even here. For some of us, none of the parents were here, right? We grew up in an orphanage. Or sometimes there was a lot of fighting here and maybe some neglect here. All sorts of things can go wrong. But our brain is always looking for who is attuning to me and who knows who I am and who's happy to be with me and what my communicative brain can be. And as we get older, our brains can actually swap people out. But we don't just let anybody sit in these areas of our brain. We only let the people that we're attached to at like a family level, right? So many of our family members, but also the closest attachments we have outside the family sit here. And they're the ones who tell me who I am, and I sit in theirs and I tell them who they are. And that's how we know who we are. By interaction, joyful interactions of reflecting each other's identity back to each other. Does that make sense? Any questions about that? Okay, this is kind of like the basis, yes. Yes. Question.
So at these four levels, are there differences between the female brain and the male brain?
They're not the control processors, no. They have a different, there's some differences in the connection between the right and left brain, but all of this stuff is the same for male and female. But there's other things that are a little bit different, right? For example, another way to say the prefrontal cortex, it's configured. You know, it's three faces engaging with each other about who I am. That's what's happening in each one of our right prefrontal cortex, right? And these people are swapped in at a level, and these are the ones, this is where character change happens. When you reflect, that's what happened to me when I became a Christian in college, went into a college group. All of a sudden, I was having people reflect back to me something that was very different than was reflected back to me as a child. And I just started growing like crazy because we had this really deep community, really deep bonds. And we were often reflecting to each other, happy to be together and reflecting who we were, right? When we'd see it. But the interesting thing is, this is, you know, this was meant to be a very, very high joy area. And our churches, that's why our churches, it's very important that they are very high joy. But it's also important that we're bonding at a deeper than just, you know, once a week singing praise songs together, but that we're actually trying to form family bonds together so that this gets in through here. And when we come to church, we get a lot of people sitting in these chairs with each other all around, forming each other's character, right? That's why our churches need to function like families rather than Christian organizations. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, a Christian organization's primarily configured to get good Christian things done, get some good ministry done, right? But not primarily to sit people in these chairs. A family, on the other hand, primarily is concerned in getting people seated in these chairs and transforming each other's character and bringing each other up in maturity. And we also get some stuff done as well, but that's not primary. And who are the primary people in the church who help it act like a family rather than an organization? The answer is women. We men just naturally make things into organizations. Without women having significant influence in the church, almost always the church becomes a religious organization. Women are the ones that keep this being a family so that we transform each other and mature. Yeah.
So that level sounds analytical and relational, but it's not, right? Because
this is not. This happens very, very fast. 1/12 of a second.
So how are we just bringing seconds in those chairs? Just who's next to us who we're looking at?
Well, it has a list of people we are bonded to, but then let's run something through this that's gonna help.
How much time do we have?
Yeah, how much do we have? Time do we have? Till what? Are usually done at 11? 11:30, okay, good.
Okay, well,
what time is it?
11:30.
Oh, it is 11:30. So what we're gonna do is run some things through that might answer your questions on this, okay? So what's a good thing to run through? Okay, why don't you do this? I think you do that.
Okay, so let's say that we're going to run an example. I'm going outside, and I fell off a bike or get bit by a dog.
So I grew up in a family with a lot of dogs, a lot of cats. We always had animals around. So when a dog comes up to me, I love dogs. Is a dog personal to me when it's coming up to me? And as a gut dog, for me, good, bad, or scary?
Good.
It's good. Yep. And do I need to, are there people that am I all alone when things happen to me with dogs? Do people understand how much I love dogs? Yeah, normally in my family we do. Part of my identity is I love dogs, I love cats, I love animals, right?
That's who I am. I love dogs. I'm a family that we all love dogs.
We're an animal-loving family, right? This is at age eight. See, So there's this memory bank called the hippocampus that's tied to this amygdala. This amygdala is actually looking at a list of every memory that's ever happened to me. You don't realize all those memories because your conscious memory has forgotten most of the things that happened to you, but this memory bank never forgets it. So this is my brain at age eight around dogs, okay? And then one day I was riding home on my bicycle from school. I'm riding up this kind of steep hill, so I'm going kind of slow, and I see a dog running out, and it's running to me, and it grabs on to my thigh and sinks its teeth into my calf right here. And I kick it off, and I bike home. I can see blood is dripping down off my foot onto the ground. I run in, and I'm crying, and I'm telling my parents what happened. Okay? Now let's see what happened to the brain. So let's say a month later, I'm somewhere out in a park and a dog is running towards me. Is that dog personal to me? Yeah, because it's running towards me. Is that dog good, bad, or scary?
Bad, scary. So you're good. You just say good only. And you say bad. Now you two keep saying those two. So dogs were good, and we never change our minds about that. So dogs will always be good, but now we've added a bad to it. Okay? And a scary. Yeah, so let's hear this. This happens in our brain all the time. Okay? You can't hear these voices, but you can feel it in your body, right? Okay. So I get home, and my parents, in this case, they actually cared for me. They took me to the doctor. We went and talked to the family to make sure the dog had rabies shots, so we didn't have to do that, and they took care of me. So level three, was I attuned to in this? Thankfully, I was. My parents attuned to me well. And so what happens? Okay, you keep going. Bad. Once we get to here, one of the things this part of the brain has is a remote control with a mute button on it. And so if we keep level three up and we're here, you can do mute. And basically our brain's saying, thank you, amygdala, for giving us a warning of potential danger, and we'll take it over from here to see if it's actually the same thing that happened when you got bit. Right? Really what happened for me in real practice is that I never looked at dogs the same way. I was a little slower, but I didn't stop loving dogs. I was just a little bit more cautious, like, is that dog? Oh, no, the tail's wagging. Okay, I'm fine. And that's really happening in my prefrontal cortex. Okay? And then the left brain is trying to put words to it, right? Maybe at that age I'd say, man, I got bit by a dog and that was really scary, but still most dogs are good. I still like dogs, but there's some dogs I got to be careful about because that really hurt. That was scary. And that's the left brain agreeing with what happened here, right? So let's run that through it with a different result, okay? So this is after I got bit. I'm out in the park and a dog's running across the park towards me. Is that dog good, bad, or scary?
Good.
Personal to me, good, bad, or scary, good. Right?
Good.
Let's say when I got bit by the dog, I ran into the house and told my parents I got bit by the dog, and my parents said, stop complaining. Don't be a crybaby. Right? Well, is that attunement? So what happens then is that this didn't get processed level, and when this level didn't get processed, this didn't get processed for that memory. So now when I see a dog running across the park to me, we get good, bad, scary. Keep going. You fall asleep. You go to sleep. Put your head down like you fell asleep. You three fall asleep. So there's no mutant button. So this keeps going. And I'm stuck in my left brain here, right? So what does an 8-year-old think of that? Well, he thinks, I am such a bad person. I'm just a crybaby. I'm a lousy person. I feel like I'm all alone.
I will never take a risk in my life. I'm a stupid. I should not have done that. Oh. And, okay, God, can you help me? Okay. And I think on top of that, I'm a bad Christian. Because if I were a Christian, I should not have been feeling this stupid that I feel. And so I think on top of being stupid for my mom, I think I'm really a bad Christian. So now I'm feeling, I really don't know how to take this out of my head. So, well, maybe I'm going to get on my phone. The phone is not working. So maybe I'm growing up now, and maybe I can get some alcohol, or maybe I can get a cookie, or maybe I can get something that helped me to get this out of my head.
We live our lives in this state more than we realize. Where there's been some trauma, some wounds in our life that never got attuned to. We don't know who we are. So when later in life, when something similar happens, our amygdala pulls that same file and said, this is dangerous. But if we weren't attuned to, we don't have that pathway developed. This developed, these fall asleep. And our left brain starts trying to just calm, get these people to shut up. Stop saying that, right? We get angry with ourselves, we blame ourselves, we think we're bad people, or we try to escape, you know, through addictions. This is where addictions really thrive as well. This is where we get PTSD. This is where we get depression, anxiety, and all sorts of things go wrong, okay?
So, and this is the definition of trauma. Every time that we are not being attuned here, this will stay as a alert that is going to keep. Yeah, this is an alarm system that God put in our brains to help us survive. Because if I wouldn't know that it's dangerous and bad, I will run over again. So this system, the amygdala, is not logical. It will tell me forever that dogs are bad.
It's really fast.
And it's not moral. It will tell me that things are bad, that they are not morally bad. But my amygdala will keep running that alarm system to help us survive. Because maybe I came home after the dog was bitten and nobody was there to pay attention to me. So I will get the conclusion here. That is where I explain, okay, nobody pays attention to me. I better take care of myself and never ask for help ever. Because nobody will be there for me. Oh, I came home after the dog bit me, and here I found an answer. Oh, are you crying for that thing? Let me give you a good thing to cry for. And so then I would say, okay, I will not trust anybody, because the person that was supposed to take care of me even punished me. So I'm not going to trust anybody, and I'm going to run my life by myself. I don't know even if God is trustworthy. Oh, if I came home and the parents said, oh, I told you not to go out because that dog was... And so then I'm going to say, okay, my explanation is that life is scary. I'm not going to take any risks. I'm really not worth it. And that alarm will always be here until I got Jesus.
So we do we have a prayer thing that's maybe similar to some of your TPM. You might be incorporating parts of this that allow Jesus to come in and walk through this wound and give you a new result. And it's the way that trauma is healed. Okay, so we're going to kind of simulate if that happens. Okay,
so let me first take a deep breath. Because every time that I think when I was bitten by the dog, every time that I need to do something risky, I get this feeling that I should not take any risk because I'm stupid, so let me take this deep breath. Remember who Jesus is. How good was he with me? Okay, I think I'm starting to get connected to Jesus' love, and oh, Jesus, now I can see you. I know that you're real, but I couldn't feel it, but now I'm just calm myself. I kind of remember how good you have been in the past. Are you personal to me?
Oh, yes, Claudia. I'm very personal to me. I'm always with you.
Okay, look at here. I'm really, really having this panic that I think it came when that dog bit me, but it kind of had been perkling all of my life.
Yeah, I see what's going on inside of you when you see that dog and how much fear you have and how scary that was. And at the same time, you love dogs and you don't know why you're acting this way. And wow, that's really, really hard.
So I'm not crazy.
No, you're actually acting like a normal person would be afraid when a dog has bit them like this.
Do you get me?
Oh, I can see how painful this was when it happened, and also how you were alone and your parents didn't help you with that. And they were actually annoyed that you got bit. And I'm so sorry that happened.
Did you see it?
I was with you the whole time and saw what happened. I was looking forward to when you and I can talk about this. And I was very, very happy to be with you. And to let you know that in these things, you know, your family was not their, your parents weren't their best selves that day. They were very stressed. But you are in a new family now that we know each other, and you're a member of our family, and our Heavenly Father is always with us, and he never gets angry with us when bad things happen. He never blames us. Instead, he's full of compassion and kindness. He says that over and over again, and we get to experience, and he's very sorry that you got bit, but he's also glad that we get to be with you and show you that our family is different than your family. We care about it when hard things happen, and we're with you, and we're not impatient with you. Oh, you're not stupid. You're just one of my little lambs that got hurt.
And I can be brave.
You can be brave now because you know we're with you and we're backing you up. And you can even take some risks because you know that you're not alone and you'll never be alone.
And I'm not a bad Christian.
You're not a bad Christian. You just felt alone in that case, but you're not a bad Christian.
And then the left brain component now is I can explain it in a way that actually incorporates a new reality. Before, it's like, I'm alone. I'm having a panic attack. I'm such a bad person. Where's the alcohol or whatever, right? Now it's, wow, that was really scary, but I sense Jesus in it. And I was never alone. Even though my parents weren't really with me, they were stressed out about life. Jesus was with me, and we've actually talked about it, and he told me who I was, and he told me how his family works, and his family is very different than my family worked that day, and I really like Jesus's family. Even when we get bit by dogs and bad things happen to us, we're never alone, and he cares for us, and he shows us compassion. So even my left brain now has a new explanation. And so then in the future, after having this interaction with Jesus, maybe I'm at this parking lot walking across to the supermarket and there's someone with the dog and the dog gets off the leash and starts running towards me after having this interaction with Jesus. Is that dog running towards me with a leash dragging personal to me?
Yes.
Is it good, bad, or scary?
Good.
Still good, bad, and scary?
Good.
Am I alone in that now? Well, Jesus just trained my brain that I'm no longer alone. So you don't fall asleep this time. You don't fall asleep this time. Get your mute button out. Get your... And all this happens in 1/12 of a second. What that means isn't that dogs aren't no longer scary. It means I feel the emotion and my brain calms it really quickly. And I know who I am. And I can even share with my people how I had peace in a time maybe in the past I would have had a panic attack. But now I have peace, okay? Still painful, still scary, but my identity does not break down. So when we heal trauma, it's still painful. It's just we don't melt down, right? We realize we're not alone, and we know who we are, and how God's family works in that situation.
So the trauma healing is to first know that my connection with Jesus is strong and is personal, and Jesus is not scary for me. Because for many of us, church could be bad and scary. For many of us, Jesus could be bad or scary.
You will have people come into this church that Jesus is bad and scary. Can you handle that? Is this a place where you can attune to that? And this happened for good reason.
Yeah, so when you know that the amygdala is a survival mechanism, We have compassion when people say, oh, I'm so scared of, I don't know, white walls. I see a white wall and something comes and say, are you crazy? No, there is a big reason for why somebody is scared of a white wall. Oh, good reasons for, yeah.
The interesting thing too is when someone comes, we have a lot of cases where Jesus is bad and scary. And then you take them through this Emmanuel where they can feel his presence and you walk through and what we hear Jesus saying is, that was not me that did that. That was a false Jesus there. Let me explain how my heart hurt when that happened to you. And they're like, it's called a cognitive mismatch. They're like, whoa, I never knew that. And it's like a new reality. And so that's why even in churches, when people come in where Jesus is bad and scary, that's a place they can find healing if we know what we're doing.
So, I understand this, but where Scott's sitting, is it personal? Can that part of your brain just go, nope, 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 and never make anything personal? Shut down? Can that do that, or would it happen at the amygdala level?
Yeah, these never shut down, ever, 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 okay?
So it has to bypass that to get
there. Right. The area where brain shuts down is here. When we're all alone in our pain and that pain's too big for us. And when that shuts down, this shuts down. These are called our relationship circuits. Like you pop a breaker in your brain and you lose your identity and you're just trying to stop the pain. Sometimes we use busyness to stop the pain. That's where workaholism happens. I'm just going to work like crazy because when I work hard, I don't feel the pain. Right? We have all sorts of ways that our left brain tries to solve it. And they seem trying to solve it with a good reason. This is really painful, but there's a much better way, which is staying connected to Jesus and my people in the pain and seeing their new perspective, that I was not alone and that they know, they reflect back to me who I was and who I truly am. Because trauma at some level is a corrupted identity where we start believing things are true of us that are not true of us.
Trauma will be something that kind of stop here and nobody pay attention, nobody attune to me. Because when you lose someone that you love, there's no way back. And you can say, oh, I'll get over. No, this pain never gets over, because you will remember a birthday, you will get Christmas, and the pain will come back. And that's where really sometimes it's so hard that we get addicted to anything that help us to survive that pain. But God made our brain relationally so we can solve things relationally. An addiction is when I try in a non-relational way to calm down a relational pain. And so what we need to do is first name it. I'm in attachment pain. This hurts. I lost this person and it sucks. And then share, Jesus, I'm in pain. Friend, I'm in pain. Because when you share, you start kind of moving here. And you look at Jesus in the way he sees it, and you feel the comfort. And it's like me to hurt, because I love so much that losing, it makes sense that hurt that much. So I get my identity from Jesus that, okay, it's like you to hurt, because that is an evidence of how much you love.
So we're gonna close that up now, and just thank you for letting us come and share this. There's probably a lot of questions. You can later on ask questions.
Yeah, so I hope you can see there's a lot to unpack from all that's in this, and I think that's a lot of what their heart's desire is, to help to establish tools and rhythms and identities as a people to walk through this as a full-brained, heart, soul, mind, strength, every aspect of who we are. So if you do have more questions, I think they'll stick around a little bit if you'd like to talk with them more. We're going to unpack this, not just probably next week, but this is just something that we're trying to incorporate into all of what we're doing as we're trying to be wholly formed, full-formed disciples of following Jesus, and where that can get stuck in me, where that gets stuck in you, where that gets stuck in all of us, and how do we care for each other to grow into all of that. So I'll pray. Lord Jesus, do thank you that you created our brains, you created us. Just thank you that you want to walk with us through each one of those steps. Thank you that you've given us your presence, a relational solution to relational hurt and pain. Just thank you for Michael and Claudia, and pray, Lord, that you just help us to unpack, what do you have for us in this? What's the importance? Why is this personal to us? And how can we grow more fully, more whole, as you would have us in your image? In your name we pray. Amen. All right.